So, if you write a legally binding will today, right, like completely of sound mind, and you explicitly leave your entire life's fortune to your new spouse, but, and here's the kicker, you forget to update a single tiny drop-down menu on some ancient web portal from 10 years ago.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Yeah, your ex-spouse is going to get every single penny, and there is absolutely nothing your new spouse or a probate judge or anyone can do about it.
Nothing at all.
It's terrifying. So today we're doing a deep dive into the completely counterintuitive power of estate law. And real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's basically everything you need to pass this exam without totally losing your mind reading textbook definitions. Check it out at certfuel.com.
You really need it because that exact scenario you just described,
Yeah.
the ex-spouse getting all the money despite the brand new will, that is exactly why this topic represents about 3% of the Series 65 exam.
Right. Which is what, like two or three
Yeah,
questions?
exactly. Two or three questions. But they are incredibly dense, multi-layered, scenario-based gotchas.
The worst kind.
Truly. The examiners, they're really testing whether you understand the hidden architecture of the financial system. Because these rules dictate who controls the money,
Yeah.
who gets it when someone dies, and exactly how much the IRS gets to skim off the top.
And as an investment advisor representative, you're the front line, right? You are the one looking at these client account forms. If you don't know the hierarchy of these rules, I mean, you're going to cost your clients millions of dollars.
Oh, easily. And
Yeah.
you'll probably get sued.
Yeah, big time. But since dry legal lectures are just, well, they're the absolute enemy of focus, especially if you're studying with ADHD and have a million other things fighting for your attention, we are not going to just read you a list of definitions
Yeah,
today.
please don't.
We are going to learn this entire unit through the chaotic, messy, and highly taxable lives of three fictional clients. You, the listener, you are going to be advising them on your exam, so you really need to know their exact psychologies.
It really is the best way to learn it. I mean, it's one thing to just memorize a legal term. It's an entirely different level of mastery to see how that specific rule financially ruins a specific person just because they didn't understand the underlying logic.
Exactly. So, listener, let me introduce you to the cast of characters whose financial lives are entirely in your hands today.
That's your.
First, we have Careless Carl. So, Carl is, he's that guy who always misses the fine print.
Oh, I know a few Carls.
Right. He forgets to update his forms. He never checks his mail. He just assumes everything will, work itself out. And he constantly stumbles into the worst possible tax traps because he relies on common sense.
And the legal system absolutely does not care about common sense.
Not even a little bit. Next up, we have prepared Penny. Penny is the exact opposite. She's a meticulous, ruthless planner.
The color-coded binders type.
Oh, absolutely. She comes to your office with binders, a spreadsheet for literally everything. Her singular goal in life is to maximize every single tax loophole and build these impenetrable financial shields around her assets. She's playing three-dimensional chess.
We love a prepared Penny. She is the client who actually utilizes the highly complex advanced strategies that the examiners love to test.
Totally. And finally, we have Dramatic Dan.
Oh boy.
Yeah, Dan is a good guy, but he cannot seem to stop getting married, getting divorced, starting businesses, bankrupting businesses. His life is a literal soap opera.
Dan is our stress test.
Exactly. He is going to help us understand exactly what happens when family structures break down entirely and the rigid legal machinery just has to step in to divide the pieces.
So if you're listening right now, you are the advisor sitting across the desk from them. Are you ready to save Carl, Penny, and Dan from themselves?
Because to do that, we have to start at the absolute bedrock. Before we can even talk about passing assets on when someone dies, we have to understand how those assets are held while they are alive and breathing.
Right, the title on the account.
Yeah, because a title, like the actual legal framing of ownership, it's not just a name on a piece of paper. It's the invisible rule book for control.
That is the perfect way to frame it. The title dictates the rules of engagement. When you hold an asset jointly, the law looks at the specific acronym attached to that ownership to decide what rights you actually have.
Okay, let's unpack the big one first. Joint tenants with right of survivorship, or, JTWROS.
The exam loves JTWROS.
They are obsessed with it. So let's build a scenario. Careless Carl and Dramatic Dan, against all odds, decide to go into business together.
A terrible idea, but let's go with it.
Right. They buy a massive joint investment account, and the broker titles it JTWROS. They're both listed as owners. Now, let's say Carl steps off a curb and gets hit by a bus.
Tragic.
Tragic, but it happens. I want you to think about this logically for a second, listener. If Carl has two kids, does Carl's share of that joint investment account go to his kids?
I'll give you a beat to think about your answer. Logic might dictate that Carl's family gets his half of the business account right.
It just makes sense.
But the legal answer is absolutely not. It automatically, instantaneously goes to Dramatic Dan.
Wait, I want to push back on this. Carl's kids get nothing. Like zero.
Right.
What if Carl's half of the account was worth $2 million?
Nothing. Because of those three magic words in the title. Right of survivorship.
Yeah.
In a JTWROS account, when one owner dies, their share passes automatically to the surviving owner.
By what? Like a Kool-Aid order?
No. By what the legal system calls operation of law.
Okay, operation of law. Let's define that, because that sounds exactly like a phrase the exam will use to trick people. Does that mean a judge has to order it?
Actually, it means the exact opposite. Operation of law means it happens automatically outside of the court system. It's a reflex. The probate court never even gets to look at it.
So Carl's will is useless here.
Completely irrelevant for this specific asset. Even if Carl literally wrote a legally flawless will the day before he died saying, I leave my half of the joint investment account to my beloved children. It does not matter. The title of the account supersedes the will.
The moment Carl's heart stops, Dan owns the whole thing.
Exactly.
Okay, here is where it gets really messy. And this is where my logic brain starts fighting the law. Let's say Carl and Dan open this JTWROS account, but careless Carl put in 90% of the cash.
Oh, classic Carl.
Right. Dan only put in 10%. Carl is taking all the real financial risk. If Carl gets hit by the bus, surely Dan doesn't get the whole thing.
Yeah.
The law wouldn't just hand Dan a massive 90% windfall that he didn't earn. The court would look at the deposit history right there.
That is exactly what a normal person would think, which is why it's a classic exam trap.
So they don't look at the deposit.
Nope. In JTWROS, the law creates an indivisible legal fiction.
Yeah.
It does not care who contributed what. All owners have an equal, undivided interest in the whole. Period. If Carl put in 90% and Dan put in 10%, the law views them as each owning exactly 50%. And when Carl dies, Dan just absorbs the other 50%.
That is insane. So Carl essentially gifted Dan a massive amount of equity the second he agreed to those six letters.
He did. And this indivisible ownership creates an even more terrifying scenario while they're both still alive.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's say Carl doesn't die, but he and Dan get into a huge fight about the business. Dan gets angry. Now remember, Dan only put in 10% of the money. Dan calls up the broker and says, liquidate the entire account right now.
Wait, hold up. Can Dan do that without Carl's permission?
Yep.
Dan can't sell Carl's 90% contribution without Carl signing off on it.
Actually, he can. In a JTWROS account, any individual owner typically has the authority to trade, liquidate assets, and request a check. Equal ownership does not mean equal control over every single transaction. It means any owner can act as a fully authorized agent for the entire account.
That is a disaster waiting to happen.
Now, to be fair, the broker usually has to make the resulting check payable to all owners. So the check would literally say, pay to Carl and Dan. But Dan can initiate the liquidation and force the sale without Carl's consent.
So how do we fix this? What if Carl wants to pool money with Dan, but he actually wants his specific 90% contribution recognized, and he wants his share to go to his own kids when he dies?
Then you, as the advisor, must ensure they use a completely different title. They need to be tenants in common. Tuck.
Tenants in common. Okay, let's rewind time. Carl and Dan open the account, but the paperwork says tech. Now does the law recognize the 90-10 split?
Yes. That is the fundamental difference. In a tech account, ownership shares can be unequal, and they usually reflect the actual capital contributions. You can have a 60-40 split, a 90-10 split, whatever.
All right, so Carl gets hit by the bus again. He owns 90% in the tech account. What happens to his share?
This is the distinction the Series 65 exam will drill into you. In a tech account, there's absolutely no right of survivorship. It just doesn't exist.
So it doesn't go to Dan?
Dan keeps his 10%, but Carl's 90% goes directly to Carl's estate.
Which means the probate court gets its hands on it.
Precisely. It becomes part of his probate estate. Mm. A judge looks at Carl's will, and the asset is distributed according to whatever the will says.
So his kids finally get it.
Yes, eventually. But they have to go through probate court, which means lawyers, fees, and sometimes years of waiting.
So it's a huge trade-off. JTWROS avoids probate, but the survivor gets everything, disinheriting your family. Tato Okaik lets your family inherit, but it guarantees that the asset has to suffer through probate.
Exactly. You have to know what your client's actual goal is.
Okay, that makes sense for business partners. But let's shift gears to marriage, because Dramatic Dan is getting married.
Again.
Again. Third time's the charm. So Dan and his new wife open a joint investment account. Now, they could use JTWROS, but there's a highly specialized type of ownership reserved strictly for married couples in about half the states, right?
Right. It's called Tenancy by the Entirety, TBE. It's an old English common law concept, available exclusively to legally married couples.
Okay, and functionally, regarding death, it operates exactly like JTWROS, right? It has the right of survivorship.
Yes. If Dan dies, his wife automatically gets the whole account, completely bypassing probate.
So, and I know listeners are wondering this, why does it even exist? If it does the exact same thing as JTWROS, why give it a special name?
Creditor protection. That is the magic phrase you must associate with TBE on the exam. Creditor protection.
Okay, let's build an analogy for this. I always think of TBE as a financial fortress. Let's look at Dan's life. He has a mountain of debt from his previous divorces, his failed business with Carl, personal lawsuits.
Debtors everywhere.
Circling like sharks. If Dan and his new wife own their house as standard JTWROS, a creditor who has a judgment against Dan could theoretically try to force a partition, right? They could try to break in and seize Dan's 50%.
Exactly. But TBE fundamentally changes the legal geometry of the ownership. In TBE, the law does not view Dan as owning 50% and his wife owning 50%. The law views the married couple as a single, indivisible legal entity.
The marriage itself owns it.
Marriage owns 100%. Therefore, a creditor of only one spouse cannot attach the property. If Dan owes a guy $100,000, that guy cannot touch the TBE account because Dan's wife does not owe him money, and you legally cannot slice a TBE asset in half without both spouses actively consenting.
It really is a fortress. Dan can't wake up one morning and sell his half of the TBE house to pay off a gambling debt. The fortress walls are totally sealed. Both must turn their keys at the exact same time.
That's the policy reason behind the rule. It protects the innocent spouse.
But wait, we are talking about Dramatic Dan here. What happens when Dan inevitably gets divorced? Does the fortress survive the divorce?
The fortress instantly crumbles.
Instantly.
Instantly. This is a very common exam scenario.
Yeah.
The absolute prerequisite for TBE is a valid legal marriage. The exact moment the divorce decree is finalized by a judge, they're no longer a single married entity.
So the account title automatically converts.
Yes. By operational law, it converts to tenants in common tyke in almost all jurisdictions.
The invisible shield just drops.
Drops completely. They are now just two unmarried people holding an asset as tyke. And the moment it becomes tyke, Dan owns a specific divisible share.
And all those creditors waiting outside the walls.
They swoop right in and seize Dan's portion.
That is wild. Okay, we have one more major joint ownership type to cover, and this one is a massive deal for tax planning. Community property with right of survivorship. CPWROS.
This one is geographical. It is only available in community property states.
Which are?
There are 9 primary ones you should vaguely be aware of. Arizona, California, Idaho, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Washington, and Wisconsin, plus a few opt-in states like Alaska.
So, listener, if a test question explicitly mentions a client living in California or Texas, your radar should be going crazy.
Absolutely. The exam doesn't just name states for flavor text. Mm. If they mention a state, it is almost certainly a clue about community property.
And the core philosophy there is what, 50-50 split of everything acquired during the marriage?
Exactly. It doesn't matter whose name is on the paycheck. And with the right of survivorship election added on, it means when one dies, it goes straight to the survivor, avoiding probate.
Again, I have to push back. Functionally, avoiding probate and passing to the spouse. That sounds exactly like JTWROS or TBE. Why would Prepared Penny care about community property? What is her angle?
Her angle is entirely about taxes, specifically the step-up in basis loophole.
Oh, this is a big one. Let's establish the baseline here, because the exam assumes you know this, but let's connect the dots. Let's use Penny. Let's say 30 years ago, Penny bought prime real estate for $100,000. That $100,000 is her cost basis, right?
The baseline of what she paid.
Over 30 years, that asset explodes in value. Today, it is worth $1 million. If Penny decides she wants to buy a yacht and sells that asset while she is alive, what happens?
She realizes a massive capital gain. The IRS looks at the $1 million sale price, subtracts her $100,000 cost basis, and taxes her on the $900,000 of pure growth.
She's handing hundreds of thousands straight to the government.
Yep.
But what if Penny dies holding that asset? She never sells it. She just leaves it to her kids. Does the IRS come after the kids for the tax on that $900,000?
Here's where the tax code is incredibly generous. No, they do not. When a person dies and leaves an appreciated asset to an heir, the IRS grants a step-up in basis.
So the basis steps up to what?
The fair market value of the asset on the exact date of Penny's death.
So the kids inherit it, and their new cost basis isn't the original 100 grand. It's the new $1 million.
Exactly. And the kids turn around and sell that asset the very next week for $1 million. Their capital gain is calculated as $1 million minus their new basis of $1 million. The result is zero.
Zero taxes on $900,000 of growth.
That entire historical unrealized growth is wiped completely clean from the tax ledger forever.
It is a phenomenal wealth transfer tool. Okay, so how does this connect to joint accounts and community property? Where's the exam trap?
Let's say Penny and her husband own that exact same $1 million asset, but they hold it in a standard JTWROS account. The husband dies. What happens to the basis?
Well, they each own half, right?
Right. So the IRS views each spouse as owning exactly half. When the husband dies, only his half $500,000 worth gets the step-up in basis. The surviving wife's half keeps its original extremely low-cost basis.
So she only gets half the tax benefit. If she sells the whole asset later, she is still going to owe massive capital gains tax on her half of the growth.
Precisely. It is highly tax inefficient for highly appreciated assets. But if Penny and her husband live in California or Texas, and they hold that exact same asset as community property with right of survivorship...
Oh, I see where this is going. The community property rules warp the federal tax code.
They absolutely do. Because community property law views the asset as being owned by the community of the marriage, the death of one spouse terminates the entire community. Because of this legal nuance, the federal tax code grants a double step-up in basis.
Double, like both halves.
Both halves get the step-up when the first spouse dies. The surviving spouse now owns the entire $1 million asset, and her new cost basis is $1 million. If she sells it immediately, she pays zero capital gains tax on the entire thing. Her own historical growth is wiped clean, even though she is still alive.
That is wild. So listener, direct question for you. If you have a client living in Nevada, which is a community property state, and they have a highly appreciated joint stock account, and their goal is the absolute best tax outcome when the first spouse dies, what title do you recommend? JT, WRSS, or CPWROS?
I'll give you a second.
It has to be CPWRS.
Undeniably. The double step-up in basis is one of the most powerful tax advantages in the entire Internal Revenue Code.
The intersection of state property law and federal tax law creates these massive loopholes.
Okay, so we've covered joint accounts extensively. But what about individual accounts? If you own a brokerage account all by yourself, how do we make sure it doesn't get stuck in the nightmare of probate court when you die?
Because probate court is awful.
It's the worst. It's a public process. Anyone can look up your assets. It takes forever.
Often 6 months to over a year.
Right. And it drains the estate through court fees and lawyer hourly rates. So for individual accounts, we use a mechanism I like to call sticky notes.
Sticky notes. I like that.
Yeah, because conceptually, that's exactly what they are. You don't need a lawyer. You don't need a complex legal trust. You literally just log into your Vanguard Schwab portal, slap a digital sticky note on your account that says, hey, when I die, give this to my sister. And the court never has to get involved.
The formal legal terms for these sticky notes are TOD, which stands for transfer on death, and POD, which just stands for pay on death.
Mechanically, what is the difference? Do they act differently? Functionally, they are identical. The difference is purely industry terminology. TOD is used exclusively for brokerage and securities accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds. POD is the banking equivalent, checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs.
So TOD is Wall Street, POD is Main Street.
Exactly. But they both operate by contract law, by passing probate entirely.
Now, what if I change my mind? What if I put a TOD on my massive account naming my brother, but a year later, my brother completely ruins Thanksgiving dinner?
It happens.
I want to disinherit him. Do I need his permission to take him off the account?
You do not. This is a vital rule. These designations are completely revocable during your lifetime. You can change them as many times as you want.
But does my brother have any rights while I'm alive? Like, if he finds out he's the beneficiary, can he call up my broker and ask to move the money to a lower risk mutual fund?
No. Absolutely yep. not. A TOD or POD gives the named beneficiary zero rights, zero access, and zero visibility while the owner is alive. Their legal interest does not exist until the exact microscopic fraction of a second after your heart stops beating.
Okay, so TOD and POD cover investment and bank accounts. What about retirement accounts? IRAs, 401ks, life insurance?
They use sticky notes too, but we call them beneficiary designations. Same concept. You name a primary beneficiary, the first in line, and a contingent beneficiary who gets the money only if the primary beneficiary dies before you do.
Okay, listener, perk your ears up right now, put down your phone, stop whatever else you are doing. We have arrived at the ultimate exam trap of this entire unit.
This is a big one.
This concept tests your fundamental understanding of the hierarchy of legal documents. Let's check back in with Careless Carl. Carl is going through a spectacularly messy, bitter divorce. He despises his ex-wife. The very next day, Carl goes to his expensive estate planning attorney and completely rewrites his will.
Okay, brand new will.
Brand new. It explicitly states in bold, legally binding language, I leave absolutely everything I own, specifically including my employer 401k plan, to my wonderful new wife.
Very clear.
But remember, Carl is careless. He pays the lawyer, signs the will, but he never actually logs into his HR portal at work to update the beneficiary designation form on the 401k itself. So the digital form sitting on a server somewhere still names his ex-wife.
Oh, Carl.
A month later, Carl gets hit by the bus again. Here is the direct question for you, listener. Think about the legal hierarchy. Who gets the 401k? Does it go to the new wife, as explicitly written in the brand new judge-approved will? Or does it go to the ex-wife on the old, outdated HR form?
I'll give you a second to reason through this. It really feels like the new will should matter, right? He explicitly mentioned the 401k by name.
He paid a lawyer for it.
But the legal answer is the ex-wife gets the money.
Drop the hammer. The ex-wife gets every single penny.
She gets it all. And the reason why is foundational. Beneficiary designations, as well as TOD and POD forms, absolutely override a will.
Override. That is a critical word. Explain the mechanism of why, because logically it just feels so wrong.
It comes down to contract law versus probate law. A will is essentially a set of instructions written to a probate judge. It only controls assets that fall into the probate estate. But a beneficiary designation form is a binding private legal contract between Carl and the financial institution.
And they don't care about the will.
Not at all. The 401k provider only cares about the contract Carl signed with them. Because the contract dictates the transfer outside of probate, the asset never enters the probate estate. Therefore, the will never even gets the chance to govern it.
I can just imagine the scene. The new wife is in probate court, holding this expensive will, crying, pointing to the exact paragraph. And the judge just looks down and says, sorry, ma'am, the sticky note wins.
It is brutal, and it happens in the real world all the time. The exam tests this relentlessly. If a client gets divorced, the very first action an advisor should take is to aggressively force the client to update all beneficiary designations.
Wow. Okay, wait, stop right there. We need to talk about another massive point of confusion, and that is grandchildren.
Oh, yes. The Series 65 examiners are deeply, almost concerningly obsessed with grandchildren.
They really are, specifically how wealth transfers to them when a structural failure happens in the family tree. This brings us to two Latin terms you absolutely must know, per stirpes and per capita.
These are two very different legal methods for distributing assets when a named primary beneficiary dies before the original account owner does.
Okay, let's build the scenario so we can do the math. Let's bring in prepared Penny. Penny has three adult children, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. She wants to leave her massive IRA to them equally. So she names Alice, Bob, and Charlie as primary beneficiaries, 33.3% each.
Simple enough.
But tragedy strikes. Charlie dies in a sudden blimp accident. Charlie leaves behind two young kids of his own, Penny's grandchildren. A few years later, Penny passes away. So now we have structural problem. Alice is alive, Bob's alive, Charlie is dead. What happens to Charlie's one-third of the money?
That depends entirely on a tiny little checkbox Penny either did or did not check. Did she select per stirpes or per capita?
Let's do the math for both. The exam loves making you calculate this.
Let's start with per stirpes. It translates directly from Latin as by the branch or by the roots. Think of a family tree. Under per stirpes, the deceased beneficiary's share flows straight down their specific branch to their direct descendants.
Okay, so the IRA is divided into thirds at the children's generation. Alice gets her third, Bob gets his third, Charlie's third flows down his branch to his two kids. They split his share equally, so they each get half of a third. which is 1/6 of the total IRA.
Exactly right. Every branch of the family tree receives its intended proportional representation of the wealth.
Okay, that feels incredibly fair. But what if Penny checked the other box? Per capita.
Per capita translates to by the head. This method does not care about branches. It simply counts the heads of the living individuals at the designated generational level, in this case the named children, and redistributes the money equally among those living heads.
Okay, let me try the math on that. Penny dies. We look at the beneficiaries. Alice is alive. That is one head. Bob is alive. That is two heads. Charlie is dead. So he doesn't count. We have two living heads.
Right. So the IRA is no longer divided by three. It is now divided by two. Alice gets one half. Bob gets one half.
And Charlie's kids, the grandchildren, I mean, surely they get something, right?
They get absolutely nothing. Zero.
Wow. Per capita literally cuts the orphan grandchildren completely out of the inheritance, while Alice and Bob get a massive windfall.
Yes. That is the exact exam trap. If a question asks you to calculate a per capita distribution where a child has predeceased the owner, the grandchildren get zero. And here's what makes this so dangerous. Per capita is generally the default setting on almost all financial institution forms.
Wait, really? So if Careless Carl was filling out this form and he just skipped that section because he didn't know what the Latin words meant, he could accidentally disinherit his own grandchildren.
Precisely. Financial institutions default to per capita because it is legally simpler for them to just pay the living people on the form rather than hiring investigators to go find a dead person's children.
That is wild. So here is your memory hook, listener. Per stirpus saves the grandchildren. Per capita leaves them with nothing.
Very important distinction.
Okay, so sticky notes override a will. My next logical question is, why even bother having a will? Is a will just a useless, outdated piece of paper?
A will is absolutely not useless. It is the foundational safety net. This brings us to the rule books, wills and trusts. You need a will because it catches everything that does not have a sticky note attached to it.
Right, like your physical belongings, your car, your art, or just a savings account you forgot to put a POD on.
Exactly. The will dictates where all those unstickied assets go.
Let's define the core vocabulary here. If you die with a valid will, you die testate. If you die without a valid will, you die intestate.
And dying intestate is universally a disaster. State law steps in and decides who gets your belongings based on a rigid formula. It's awful for the family. So dying testate is always preferred. But, and this is a big but, even with a flawless will, those assets still have to go through probate.
Right. The court still has to validate it. So what if a will is not enough? What if prepared Penny wants to control how they get the money, when they get it, and she wants to avoid probate entirely?
But she needs to build a separate legal entity. She needs to upgrade to a trust.
I love trusts. They sound so aristocratic. But fundamentally, they're just custom-built rule books. Let's introduce the cast of characters for a trust, because the exam will use these terms interchangeably.
There are four main roles. First is the grantor, also called the settlor or creator. This is the person who originally owns the assets and funds the trust. Penny, in our scenarios.
Second is the trustee.
The manager. The legally recognized fiduciary who holds title to the assets and manages them according to the trust document. Could be a person, could be a bank.
Third is the beneficiary.
The person or charity who eventually receives the benefits of the income.
And fourth is the corpus.
The corpus, or the principal, is the actual stuff inside the trust. The cash, stocks, real estate.
Got it. Grantor makes it, trustee manages it, beneficiary gets the payout. Corpus is the stuff inside. Now, the Series 65 exam focuses heavily on the massive legal distinction between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust.
Let's do a direct comparison.
I use an analogy for this. Think of a revocable living trust as an open cardboard box. You build the box, you put your assets in, but because it's open, you can reach in and take stuff out whenever you want. You can change the rules. You can break the box down entirely. You maintain absolute total control.
Yes. The grantor maintains full legal authority to modify or terminate it. And because it holds title to your assets, the primary benefit is that the assets inside bypass probate when you die.
But, and this is a massive exam trap, what is the tax benefit of the open cardboard box?
There is zero tax benefit. Absolutely none.
Let me push back. You've hired a lawyer. You created a fancy trust. Surely there is a tax shelter here.
None. Because you still have total control. Because you can reach into the open box and take the money back. The IRS looks at it and says, nice try, Penny. That is still functionally your money.
So it's still in her taxable estate.
Exactly. And she pays personal income tax on any dividends generated inside it.
And what about lawsuits? Does it protect her from creditors?
Again, no. If she gets sued, creditors can reach right into that open cardboard box and take the money. Because legally, her control means the money is still hers to satisfy debts.
So a revocable trust is purely administrative. It avoids probate, but offers zero tax or creditor protection.
Exactly. Now compare that to an irrevocable trust.
The irrevocable trust is not an open cardboard box. It is a locked, solid steel vault. You put the money in, lock the heavy door, and throw away the key. You surrender control.
That is the defining mechanism. Once it's established and funded, you generally cannot change it, amend it, or revoke it. You have birthed a new, separate legal entity.
Why in the world would Prepared Penny willingly lock her wealth in a steel vault she can't access?
To harvest the benefits the open box doesn't offer. Because she severed her control, the IRS acknowledges the money is no longer hers. Therefore, the assets are completely removed from her taxable estate. If they grow to $10 million, that growth is completely insulated from her estate taxes.
And asset protection?
Phenomenal asset protection. If Penny gets sued, they cannot seize the assets in the irrevocable trust because Penny herself has no legal right to access them. You can't take from Penny what Penny doesn't own.
It's the ultimate trade-off. Give up control to gain massive tax and creditor shields.
Exactly. And on the exam, they will try to trick you. They'll say, a wealthy client wants to dramatically reduce their estate tax burden, but insists on maintaining full control. Should they use a revocable or irrevocable trust?
And the answer is neither. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. You have to pick one path.
Precisely.
Okay, let's talk about the timing of when these trusts come into existence. Inter vivos versus testamentary.
Inter vivos is Latin for between the living. It's just a living trust, drafted and funded while the grantor is alive. It avoids probate.
But a testamentary trust is entirely different. And listener, pay attention to the wording here.
A testamentary trust is created by the specific terms of a last will and testament. It does not exist while the person is alive. It's essentially instructions inside the will that say, when I die, form a trust for my kids.
And because it is born out of the will,
it must go through probate.
Yes. Do not let the word trust trick you into assuming it bypasses the court. Testamentary trusts, DO go through probate. The judge oversees the birth of the trust.
It trips up a lot of test takers. Living trusts avoid probate. Testamentary trusts are born in probate.
All right, let's do a rapid-fire rundown of specialized trusts. First up, the bypass trust, also called a credit shelter trust. Why use this?
To fully utilize the estate tax exemption, every person gets a certain amount they can pass on tax-free. Spouses can transfer unlimited amounts to each other. But if a wealthy husband leaves everything directly to his wife, he wastes his personal exemption. When the wife dies, she only has her single exemption for the whole massive estate.
So the bypass trust fixes that?
Yes. The husband's will directs his exemption amount into a bypass trust. It provides income to the wife for life, but she doesn't own the principal. When she dies, it bypasses her taxable estate and goes to the kids. Both exemptions are fully utilized.
Brilliant. Next, generation skipping trust, or GSD.
Skips the children's generation entirely. Transfers assets directly to grandchildren. It avoids having the assets taxed at the intermediate children's level.
Okay, here is one of my favorites. The grantor retained annuity trust. This is where Penny flexes on the IRS. How does it work?
It's a sanctioned bet against the government's assumed interest rates. Penny transfers a highly appreciating asset into the GRAT for a set term, say 5 years. The trust pays Penny a fixed annuity payment back, mathematically calculated based on an IRS mandated interest rate.
So if the IRS assumes 4% growth, the trust pays Penny back her principal plus 4% over 5 years.
But what if the asset actually grows at 20% a year? At the end of 5 years, Penny gets all her money back plus the 4%. But there is a massive pile of extra money left over inside the trust.
What happens to that leftover money?
It passes to her beneficiaries, completely free of gift and estate taxes. It's a heads I win, tails we tie scenario.
Incredible. Finally, the CRT, Charitable Remainder Trust.
Penny transfers a highly appreciated asset into the CRT. The trust sells it tax-free, provides steady income to Penny for her life, and whatever is left when she dies goes to charity. She gets a partial income tax deduction up front.
Okay, that is a comprehensive look at trusts. But how does the exam actually test you on this? Because you won't just see them from one angle.
Right. On the Series 65, you will encounter trusts through three distinct lenses. Lens one is trusts as estate vehicles.
Yeah.
What we just covered. Bypassing probate, revocable versus irrevocable.
Lens two.
Trusts as client types. When you manage an account where the client is a trust, you take instructions from the trustee, not the beneficiary. And the trustee is bound by the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, the UPIA. You have to balance the needs of current income beneficiaries with future growth beneficiaries.
And the third lens.
Trusts as tax entities. An irrevocable trust is its own separate taxpayer. It files a form 1041, and this is vital. Trusts have brutally compressed income tax brackets. They hit the top 37% tax bracket at just around $16,000 of retained income.
Wait, 16 grand? A single human being doesn't hit that until they make hundreds of thousands. Why is it so punitive?
It's historical. Decades ago, ultra-wealthy families would create 50 separate trusts for their kids to divide their income and multiply their lower tax brackets. Congress got furious and compressed the trust brackets. If a trust hoards income, it gets taxed at the maximum rate almost immediately.
So how do you avoid that hit?
You distribute the income to the human beneficiaries, the trust gets a deduction, and the income is taxed at the beneficiary's much lower personal rate.
Wow. Same trust, three totally different angles.
All right, let's take a deep breath. We have spent a lot of time on dying in taxes, but what happens when the family structure breaks down while everyone is still alive? Let's check back in on Dramatic Dan.
It is time to look at divorce and retirement assets.
Dan's third marriage is officially over. The judge bangs the gavel. Dan is 40 years old. He has an employer-sponsored 401k with $100,000. The judge says, Dan, give half of that 401k 50 grand to your ex-wife.
A very common scenario.
Now, normally, if a 40-year-old just pulls 50 grand out of a 401k, two terrible things happen. Right? First, he owes income tax on the entire 50,000. Second, because he's under 59 and a half, the IRS slaps him with an additional 10% early withdrawal penalty.
So it would cost him a massive fortune just to execute the judge's order. But federal law provides a shield for this exact situation, the QDRO, QDRO Qualified Domestic Relations Order.
A QDRO formally recognizes the right of an alternate payee, the ex-spouse, to receive a portion of the retirement plan benefits.
And the why behind it?
It is the federal divorce exception to the penalty. When retirement assets are divided pursuant to a valid QDRO, the 10% early withdrawal penalty is completely waived, regardless of age.
Okay, here is the ultimate exam trap regarding QDROs. Listener, pay close attention to the specific type of account. Let's say Dan is a self-employed consultant, and he has all his money in a traditional IRA. He gets divorced. He tells his lawyer, draft me a QDRO to split my IRA without the penalty. Direct question, does the QDRO work for Dan's IRA?
I will give you a beat. They're both retirement accounts. Does a QDRO apply to an IRA? The answer is, and no. Emphatically, legally, no.
No. Why not? Clients get furious about this. They're both retirement accounts.
It comes down to federal labor law. QDROs are a creation of ERISA. ERISA only applies to employer-sponsored qualified plans. 401ks, 403bs, pensions. IRAs are not employer plans. They are not governed by ERISA. A federal QDRO literally has no legal jurisdiction over a personal IRA.
So how do you split an IRA in a divorce?
You use a mechanism called a transfer incident to divorce. It achieves the same result, but the legal mechanism is completely different. The exam loves tricking people on this. QDRO equals qualified employer plans only.
Okay, back to the 401k, where the QDRO does work. Dan's ex-wife is about to receive $50,000. What are her tax options?
She generally has two choices. Option one, a rollover. She can roll the $50,000 directly into her own personal IRA or her own employer's plan. It's a completely non-taxable event. The money keeps growing.
That's what Penny would do. What's option two?
Option two is she just takes a cash distribution. The money is fully taxable as ordinary income. In the year she receives it, she owes income tax. But, and this is the magic of the QDRO, she pays NO 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Huge benefit. Now, let me explore the limits of the QDRO. Can she use the QDRO to demand the plan pay her out in a lump sum cash check if the specific 401k plan strictly forbids lump sum payouts?
No, absolutely not. A QDRO cannot require the plan to provide any type or form of benefit that it does not already offer to normal participants.
Yeah.
And it cannot increase the total overall benefits payable. It divides what is there strictly under the rules that already exist.
Got it. All right, we are moving into our final major topic area. Sometimes you willingly choose to give your money away to charity. Prepared Penny is highly philanthropic, but she wants maximum tax efficiency. So she uses a DAF, a donor-advised fund.
DAFs have exploded in popularity, making them highly testable. Think of it as a charitable checking account.
You open the account with a sponsoring organization like Fidelity Charitable, and you dump a massive amount of money into it all at once.
Step one. The contribution is irrevocable. Step two, the donor receives an immediate current year tax deduction for the full amount, even if the money hasn't gone to a working charity yet. Step three, the assets grow completely tax-free inside the DAF. And step four, over time, the donor recommends which charities should receive grants.
Wait, recommends grants? Why just recommend? It's Penny's money.
Not anymore. That is the legal requirement of a DAF. The initial contribution is irrevocable. The sponsoring organization now fully owns and controls the money. Penny only retains advisory privileges. Technically, the sponsor has the final say and can say no.
You get the massive tax deduction up front, but you give up absolute legal control forever. So why is this so powerful?
Let's talk about the double tax benefit of appreciated securities. This is testable gold. Penny bought stock for $10,000. Today, it's worth $50,000. What happens if she transfers the shares directly into the DAF? A financial magic trick. First, she pays zero capital gains tax on the $40,000 of gross. It is totally wiped out. Second, she gets a charitable income tax deduction for the full $50,000 fair market value to offset her personal income.
She entirely avoids the tax she would have owed, and she gets a massive deduction against her current income. It's a double win.
Arguably the single most tax-efficient maneuver in the entire tax code.
Now, on the exam, they will make you compare a DAF to a private foundation. Think of a private foundation as the old school billionaire way of giving. You have to hire lawyers, establish a board, file complex tax returns. DAFs are the modern, easy way.
What are the specific numerical differences the exam wants you to know?
Let's do a side-by-side comparison. First, tax deduction ceilings. With a DAF, you get a higher ceiling. You can deduct cash contributions up to 60% of your adjusted gross income, or AGI. Appreciated assets up to 30%.
DAF is 60% for cash, 30% for stock. What about a private foundation? A private foundation is far more restrictive. It's exactly half. Cash contributions up to 30% of AGI and appreciated assets up to 20%.
So memory aid, DAF equals double the deduction ceiling. But what about the rules for actually giving the money away? Let's say Penny dumps $5 million into her DAF. Does she ever legally have to give that money to a real charity?
No. Under current tax law, a D has absolutely no minimum annual distribution requirement. She could let it sit there, growing tax-free for the rest of her life without ever granting a single dollar. Critics call it a tax break without a deadline.
But a private foundation has a strict deadline.
Correct. Private foundations must distribute at least 5% of their net investment assets every single year. If they fail, they face crippling excise tax penalties.
And there's one more penalty private foundations face just for existing, right?
Yes. The net investment income excise tax. They pay a 1.39% excise tax on their net investment income every year. DAFs pay zero excise tax.
So to recap, DAFs have double the tax deduction ceiling, zero minimum payout requirement, and zero excise tax on growth. Private foundations have lower limits, force a 5% yearly payout, and tax your investment income. It's obvious why Penny prefers the DAF.
Absolutely.
All right, pencils down. Stop taking notes. If you zoned out, tune back in right now. It is time for the rapid-fire recap. These are the absolute top testable takeaways.
Number one, beneficiary designations, TOD, and POD forms absolutely override a will. The private contract controls the asset, bypassing probate.
Number two, JTWROS creates an indivisible fiction that bypasses probate and goes entirely to the surviving owner. TTEC creates divisible shares that go to the deceased person's estate, requiring probate.
Number three, Posterpa saves the grandchildren by passing the share straight down the branch. Per capita redistributes only among the living heads of the named generation, leaving orphaned grandchildren with nothing.
Number four, revocable trusts are open boxes. They avoid probate but offer zero tax or creditor benefits. Irrevocable trusts are steel vaults, massive tax and creditor benefits, but you surrender control completely.
Number five, testamentary trusts are created by instructions inside a will, and therefore they DO go through probate court.
Number six, QDROs waive the 10% early withdrawal penalty in a divorce, but they only apply to ERISA-qualified employer plans like 401ks. They never apply to personal IRAs.
And number seven, donor-advised funds provide higher upfront tax deduction limits than private foundations, and DAFs have no minimum annual payout requirement.
Boom. You are now armed to navigate the messiest client scenarios on the exam. But before we let you go, I want to leave you with one final thought. Zoom out for a second.
We're currently living through the largest intergenerational wealth transfer in the history of human civilization. The baby boomer generation is preparing to pass on tens of trillions of dollars.
Trillions of dollars. And the entire fate of that money, who gets to be a billionaire, which charities get funded, how much the IRS takes, none of that is decided by grand philosophical debates. It's decided by whether careless Carl remembered to check a Purse Scripts box. It's decided by a digital sticky note. The biggest financial shifts in our society come down to the exact paperwork mechanics you are memorizing right now.
The rules matter, because the rules are the invisible machinery that decides where the power and the money ultimately flow.
It has been awesome unpacking this incredibly complex machinery with you today. Keep studying, keep grinding through those practice questions, and we will see you on the next deep dive.